So as we've traveled around the world, we had this idea that everyone should have a chance to be included in getting the same kind of information and knowledge required to make good investment choices. And with that, we decided to put on our own conference online and completely free at crypto2020summit.com.
Yes, Pizza Mind is very correct. We are putting on the Crypto 2020 Summit. This is a free online conference from January 29th to 31st. And we want everybody who's listening to this to go sign up. It's free only for a limited time. This is a conference that you guys can tune into on your computer, at your home. You could be in your PJs. You could be sipping tea. It's going to be awesome. Every day we're adding more speakers to the lineup. You could go check it out at www.crypto2020summit.com. Pause this episode right now. If you haven't signed up yet, you could do it on your mobile. You could do it on your iPad. You could do it on your BlackBerry. You could do it on your MacBook. Do it. Do it. As Shia LaBeouf would say, just do it. And Nike. Okay, bye. What is up, Crypt Nation? Good citizens of Crypt Nation. We are here in San Francisco, Blockchain Week, and I am joined by a very special guest in person today, Thomas Bertani, the president of Poseidon Group and the founder of Provable and IDO. And we're going to get into all of that. But first, Thomas, welcome to the show.
Hello, Bryce. Thank you for having me here today.
We are very, very, very pleased. So cryptocurrency, it's kind of a new space. Kind of not. I don't know. It's been around for about 10 years. But in your mind, when you're thinking about, you know, solving problems in the crypto space, do you differentiate between cryptocurrency and blockchain? Or is it one and the same for you?
I wouldn't say it's the same. I mean, the term like cryptocurrency to me is really confusing because crypto is like a term that sounds, I would say, weird for the average Joe. It doesn't say much on what it is. And currency is something that, you know, is a term that we use every day for, you know, fiat currencies. But I mean, from my experience, people don't really know what a currency is. So it's really complicated for people to understand, you know, that cryptocurrency means, you know, a new kind of asset class living on, you know, blockchain. So I think there is a huge difference between, you know, blockchain and cryptocurrency. In general, I would say that cryptocurrency is like a specific type of crypto assets that are implemented on top of specific blockchain platforms. While blockchain is just, you know, a wider term that today probably just represents, you know, the industry of, you know, decentralized technologies, you know, being used to implement, you know, decentralized applications such as some crypto assets or things like that. So it's an entire new ecosystem. I think like blockchain is very specific technical term that today is like representing this ecosystem as a whole. Also in the mind of, you know, normal people, they see blockchain as this, you know, strange ecosystem they don't know much about, where probably Bitcoin lives or some other, you know, cryptocurrencies are running, while, you know, cryptocurrency is just a mess of a term that I wish we were not using.
Yeah, I feel like people, it's just a buzzword at this point, it doesn't really hold much weight to it. And, you know, we talk about blockchain and crypto on here, but I feel like every episode we always need to just keep on breaking it down, because it does contain so much weight behind it. And another thing we talk about a lot on is DeFi, decentralized finance. And everybody has a little different explanation of it. And I know Provable is operating in the decentralized finance space. So, I mean, we could talk about what is decentralized finance, but why don't we talk about what is finance?
Well, I guess, you know, the reason why DeFi as a term is being used is exactly because of the limitations we find in finance today. The need for a new term, such as, you know, DeFi, which is, you know, basically an abbreviation of, you know, decentralized finance, so DeFi, something that doesn't scare people and that, you know, represents something new, is like strongly need to represent a radical change. So finance is like a sector that has been around for like, I guess, centuries at least. So, yeah. So, you know, it's I guess the major problem that we are trying to solve with DeFi is the overregulation that we have seen in finance over recent years, really. I would say the last century mostly. So we wouldn't really need decentralized technologies if there wasn't a problem with traditional finance. So it's not that we are reinventing the wheel just because, you know, it's fun. It's because there are some real problems, such as the lack of transparency and overregulation that makes it really complicated for companies like startups to basically innovate and to change in a way that can be truly disruptive. So I feel like DeFi is like maybe a conjugation of fintech, really, where fintech is like trying to innovate on top of regulation, basically, and on top of traditional finance, while DeFi is trying to reject all the assumptions on the fact that finance is working as intended and trying to reinvent the foundations of it.
Yeah, I know that there is currently a bill trying to get passed in American Congress called the Financial Services Innovation Act by Representative Patrick McHenry. And he's basically proposing, we've talked a little bit about it on the show before, but he's talking about proposing a permanent public beta is what he's calling it for decentralized finance. And he's like, I don't like the term sandbox because sandbox doesn't get taken seriously. But basically what it is that every office that has any sort of regulatory control in America, whether it's SEC, the CFTC, they get an office within it that is this new public beta area that people could come in and bypass all regulations or most regulations, have some goals and stipulations and stuff. But anyhow, so I think it's cool that, like, you know, fintech is trying to innovate on the regulatory side. And then now we have crypto that is now getting its kind of place where it's trying to innovate without regulation. So there's a lot of interesting things going on. I definitely want everybody listening to go check out the Financial Services Innovation Act. And so what are the kinds of things that we could do in DeFi? Is it just lending? Like, kind of whenever I see new DeFi projects come out, it's basically just peer-to-peer lending. But what more is there that we can do with this technology?
Yeah, that's a good question. Actually, I think that the ecosystem that we see today is sort of limited by the concept of over-collateralization that we see being like adopted by most of the projects. That's because, like, the assets that live on a specific blockchain, such as Ethereum, are limited right now. So we have things like stable coins or, DAI with MakerDAO or Ethereum itself, like Ethers, that live on that single platform called Ethereum. And most DeFi platforms are being built on top. So when we create new tools within this infrastructure, what happens is that we need to typically we need to put a collateral to, for example, create a synthetic assets or to collateralize a financial instrument or whatever is needed. So this is the example with MakerDAO, for instance, but it's also an example with synthetics, with all the synthetic assets they make. And it's the case for many other like low-level infrastructure tools that are being built right now. And in all those cases, there is like the need to like over collateralize a given asset, so that if something wrong happens, basically you lose your collateral in a way which can be fully enforced on the blockchain. So this gives you full transparency, because basically you are sure that nothing wrong will ever happen, and that in the worst case you will get enough collateral to cover for a potential loss. So this means that basically the full transparency provided by smart contracts is giving you like some guarantees on the fact that the risk is close to zero. So what else can we implement? Well, I guess we are starting with the foundations, right? Which is, you know, those new assets and those new like stable assets, exchanges, and, you know, we can build any financial instrument on top potentially. So this is still a long way to go, because, you know, DeFi is like just growing now, and I guess this term didn't even exist 8 months ago. So I think it's quite impressive to see such a growth in such a short time span. So I'm really impressed about this. But in general, I think we see many more financial instruments coming, which are more complex than the ones we see today. So getting interest is something critical because, is something that could power many other applications on top, and that is sort of appealing also for the average Joe that is not part of blockchain. So in turn, this could encourage liquidity, and this could help this ecosystem to gain more significance, because right now its size is still slightly above $500 million, so it's still relatively small. However, having those dynamics and those incentives will slowly encourage additional liquidity to make it into this space, and will gradually make it more and more relevant.
So I hope everybody's picking up on what he's putting down here. It's basically the fact that the smart contracts and the blockchain are so transparent that you could at all times understand your risk profile. And kind of in the 2008-2009 crisis, one of the reasons why a lot of the banks went down is because they didn't even know what risk they were exposed to at the time, which seems absurd, but at these big corporations, a lot of the times things get so muddied that you don't even understand where your risk is. So that's something that putting that on the blockchain and making it publicly auditable at all times kind of reduces everybody's risk that's involved in that ecosystem. So that's really cool. So one of my things that I hear a lot of backlash on is the Bitcoiners think that DeFi is a dumb term because With the invention of Bitcoin, that was when DeFi was made possible. But like you said, quote unquote, DeFi never really got the name until Ethereum came about and people started making these Ethereum apps. So this is kind of a two-part question. Is one, are you more bullish on Bitcoin than Ethereum, or more bullish on Ethereum than Bitcoin? And also, what is it about Ethereum that makes it so DeFi possible? Like, is it just the fact that it's easier to code on, or what is that thing going on right there?
Okay, so I guess this is quite controversial, right? Ethereum versus Bitcoin. I was defining myself a Bitcoiner till a few years ago, as basically there was nothing else in the space, really. So since I joined in 2012, there was just Bitcoin. And I remember there were the first altcoins coming out, such as, Namecoin or Litecoin, all these first ones. And it was quite funny at the time because it wasn't really, it was just a chance to experiment. So people were just, playing around with those, forks of Bitcoin to check if something else could be done, something else which was considered relevant. And then, Ethereum was released a few years later. And I remember starting working on it very early. The mainnet was just launched. I think it was August. If I'm not wrong, it was 2015. So in September, I remember writing my first smart contract, and it was quite impressive, mostly because of the ease to write those applications. So I would say that the main innovation that we got from Ethereum is the simplicity to build decentralized applications, which is something that could potentially be done to some extent also with Bitcoin, but the complexity is so high that very few developers are actually capable to do so, which somehow makes it harder, to basically get traction, because, there are so many potential ways to build on it that, it's not necessary true that the way you are you have decided you will build something is the one that most people will like. So I think this is mostly the approach with Bitcoin. Let's get given a specific use case out there. Let's show the code to implement it, and if the use case is something people like or people find useful, then we will improve it, we'll keep improving it until it's super efficient. So this has been the case, for example, with the multisig proposal that now we have been using for a while, also for segregated witness and for many other changes in Bitcoin. While with Ethereum, it basically moves to like a higher level this specific problem. So basically, when you write an application, you don't really care about the efficiency of it. I mean, the fact that there could be a more efficient application doesn't mean that yours will not be used or that yours will not be liked by your audience. You could still use an inefficient application on Ethereum. But the fact that everyone can write an application on Ethereum makes it very appealing, because basically you could have anyone propose their own use cases that maybe nobody had thought of. And if someone likes it, maybe they will eventually improve it, or maybe not. But the fact that it's natively interoperable, or as people say now, like composable, then it means basically that you can just work on your own application and then interoperate with whatever is already out there without having to optimize every single bit. So I think that's something quite significant with Ethereum. The fact that smart contracts can natively speak to each other is like critical for the success of the application. It's also probably one of its limits. I remember one of the main criticism from that Bitcoiners always mention is a conference that I attended in Austin, Texas in 2014, where Vitalik was speaking there. And he was explaining to everyone how cool Ethereum was going to be, and how powerful smart contracts could be on top of the Ethereum virtual machine. Like the flexibility of writing smart contracts in something that looked like JavaScript, like in Solidity, right? And someone from the crowd asked him, how on earth he believed the smart contracts could be safe, given that Turing completeness was such complicated to get right on a blockchain. And his answer, I think, is quite interesting. As back then, what he said is that he didn't expect any smart contract to ever be longer than 100 lines of code. So he expected them to be very short and to be very specific, which is not what we have today, really. So the market evolved differently than what we thought. Indeed, securing those applications is turned out to be quite a challenge. But I think we are getting there. The fact that the developers community of Ethereum is is the biggest in the blockchain space makes it interesting to find solutions to all kinds of problems that arise, such as security problem and the challenge of writing smart contracts that are not just, possibly efficient, but that are also secure. As if we write transparent smart contracts that are not, we end up with problems such as the DAO and many others that we would like to avoid if possible.
Very fascinating. So let's jump on over to the problem that you're trying to solve at Provable. And I think the name of the problem is called an Oracle problem. But can you go ahead and tell me what you're trying to solve with your platform, Provable? What is it? Why do we need it?
I think it's interesting to go back a few years and check how the Oracle problem was defined in 2012 and even before. Actually, this term has been used very early, since 2010 or 2011, and it was defined in the Bitcoin Wiki. So I don't know if many people know, but Satoshi, before leaving, helped to start a resource for Bitcoin that has existed pretty much since its inception, which is the Bitcoin Wiki. So this is a community maintained a knowledge base where people could define the challenges or the terms or things like that. And at the beginning, all Bitcoin specific terms were defined there, and there were some active discussions as well. It's basically a wiki format, so anyone can contribute. Something that was listed there is also this Oracle term. And I remember preparing a presentation in fall 2014, where I was to explain to an general audience, a non-technical audience, smart contracts. And smart contracts back then were not really Ethereum specific. They were just the concept of having like some more or less complicated logics built on top of a blockchain platform, such as even just a multisig address, like an address where more than one people need to sign in order for a transfer to happen or to be successful. So, and oracles were part of that presentation. So I did my first research on oracles to explain it to like to other people with oracles math. And the oracle problem, since its inception, has been around solving the issue of the blockchain being a walled garden. Like, we say that the blockchain is a walled garden to mean that it's impossible for the blockchain to speak with anything external to it, such as the internet. So if you want to design, you know, a smart contract for like on Ethereum or on Bitcoin or on any blockchain platform, really, you have this limitation. So it's impossible to basically get data from the real world, because the way we get data from the real world, typically, is via the internet. Like, we have services that, for simplicity, I like calling data sources, that provide data, such as what is the price of a given asset? What's the temperature in San Francisco? Or is a given flight late? Things like that. So any real-world event or data that lives on the internet is sort of interesting if we want to build an ecosystem of applications that are decentralized, where those applications have an impact on the real world. Because if there is no way for those applications, you know, to reach out to the real world to understand what's going on, it will be impossible for them in turn to like have any kind of impact. So
sorry, just to interrupt real quick, so kind of to recap, because I feel like that was a lot. So we're kind of going into a world of like autonomous machine to machine value transfer, but if these machines are getting data from the real world, like you said, the flight from San Francisco is late, but it's supposed to execute a payment, a trustless payment, automatically and trustlessly. But if it gets that data from a centralized source, that centralized source could be corrupted. Is that what you're saying? And it wouldn't make the entire system decentralized, because if you bring in an off-chain source of data, it could actually execute the smart contract completely wrong. I think that's what I'm hearing.
Yeah, that's correct. And actually, I think at this stage, I could maybe share that the first smart contract I wrote, the one I was mentioning earlier, was in September 2015, was exactly the one you just explained, which is basically, it was actually the winning project of the London FinTech Week Hackathon in 2015. And just 1 month after the release on mainnet of Ethereum, of the Ethereum mainnet, I was in a team where we built like a flight delay insurance. So basically, we were using a smart contract on Ethereum to check if a given flight was late or not. And this smart contract was automatically triggering a payout in case the flight was late more than 3 hours or things like that. So one problem we faced was the fact that we couldn't get the data for the flight, like to understand if a given flight was late or not. And the data is easy to fetch once you know, you browse the internet. You just look on Google. You can look like on many different data sources, you know, such as like the airport website or the airline or like professional like feeds of flight data. And basically, what we did was using a very initial version of Provable that back then was called Oracle Eyes. And basically, that was an oracle. That was like this entity which somehow solves the problem of unavailability of data on the blockchain. So the oracle problem is indeed the impossibility for smart contracts to communicate with anything external to the blockchain where they live. And the oracle is this new weird intermediary, if you want. I mean, conceptually, it's weird because it's like counterintuitive. It's a new intermediary in an ecosystem that is trying to get rid of all intermediaries. So why do we need that intermediary? Well, to solve the limitation. And how does the intermediary solve it? Well, basically, it doesn't leave that oracle that somehow provides data from the internet to the blockchain, doesn't live on the blockchain. It lives in part on the blockchain and in part outside. So it can easily communicate because it's designed to basically have a piece, a smart contract component, and another component living on the internet. So basically it's built to solve that specific problem, and it does it not just for itself, providing data to its own smart contract, but it can provide data from the internet to any other smart contract. So is it an intermediary? Well, yes, because it's somehow enabling the communication with the internet, while natively the smart contracts wouldn't be able to do so. But is it bad? Well, not really, because it turns out that this intermediary can be trustless. So we can build it in a way where the data that we get from the Oracle cannot be tampered with by the Oracle. So we know that the Oracle is like an important component, which is complementary to the blockchain itself to get data, but it cannot really do anything bad, because anything it would do that's potentially damaging for the smart contract logic could be detected and blocked by the receiving smart contract. So today we see like a variety of oracles being implemented. There are many teams working on, you know, building an oracle. Back then there were really few. We were among the first ones, and Provable has been running that oracle service since then, since this, you know, flight delay insurance prototype in September 2015. Actually, we started operating even before then on Bitcoin. We had a system where you could trigger Bitcoin payments depending on real-world events. Like you could say, if a flight is late, then approve a certain Bitcoin transaction. But we moved to Ethereum straight after the mainnet release in September 2015. And we have been live since then. So today we are basically being used by approximately 1,000 applications in the Ethereum space. And more than 200 are reaching out every month to get some kind of data. They're like price feeds or randomness data in the case of casinos that maybe need to get dice thrown outside of the blockchain, or any kind of financial data, really, also flight delays or temperature data. I mean, we have seen a bunch of different data sources being used.
So back to the problem of these data sources being tamperable or spoofable, right? So I kind of imagine maybe let's just take the example of Augur or something. Say we have an Augur contract that's set up that says, for the World Series, right? If the Astros beat the Nationals, then this player or this, participant of the contract wins and gets paid one ETH, and the loser has to pay that one ETH. And they call out to an API from ESPN.com to settle this contract. But ESPN.com is a centralized data source that, could have permissions and could have tampering and all that stuff. And so some hacker hacks into ESPN and says, even though the Astros won, this is actually, the World Series is tonight, so I don't know who's actually won yet, but this is going to play after. So, okay, so the Astros won, but I have the API expose that the Nationals won. So all the contracts that are calling out to that API are essentially tampered with and executed in an improper way. So do oracles solve that problem, or is that something that still needs to be solved? And how do you guys think of that?
That's a very good question, as it's a very little understood problem. The main fact here is that data is mostly trusted. So if I was to ask you how many views a given YouTube video had, that question is like inherently trusted, because basically there is no way to know what's the correct answer. We need to ask to like YouTube as a trusted authority, as YouTube may report a wrong number, but the question is around basically the number of views that YouTube is claiming a given video had. So it's not possible to know in principle how many viewers there have been. We just know that according to YouTube, that specific video had a certain number of views. So it's not always like that. But even if I was to ask something like much less platform specific, such as what's the temperature in San Francisco, well, that will be quite problematic because I'm not saying anything around, this question is really vague. I mean, I didn't say anything around the specific time, the location, the number of decimals, the units I expect, or like what kind of sensors I want to trust. Also, you know, we could do an average, but, among which sensors and how do we know those sensors are not tampered with? How do we know there is not someone, that is like heating the sensors from a short distance or things like that? So this turns out to be a really complex problem to solve. And I think that it cannot really be solved in principle in most cases. So we need to trust someone. The important part is that we are not trusting the Oracle. Like the Oracle is just delivering the data to the blockchain. So we shouldn't be trusting the Oracle. We don't trust the Oracle. We don't want to trust the Oracle, but the data source is somehow trusted. So we need to define the data source as the data source is the one that where the data originates from. So if we something simpler to solve is like around crypto price feeds, for example. Like if I was to ask, which is, by the way, a common question for an oracle, what's the price of ETH in US dollars? That would be a very easy problem to solve because the reality is that the price is mostly built out of like the market data on those markets where we have like most of the liquidity. So it would be enough to get as data sources the exchanges where we have most liquidity. So would we be trusting them? Yes. Does it mean that we are potentially not getting the price? Well, if I was to ask you what's the price of ETH today, you would still look on those sources. So this turns out to be the price we perceived as correct. So I don't think this could easily be tampered with in this specific case as data, but in other cases such as, you know, number of views of YouTube video or things like that, there is a central authority that we are trusting, which is YouTube in that specific case. So it strictly depends on the data. In some cases, there are like a single trust lines we need to open. In other cases, there are not. But in most cases, we need to trust someone. The important part is that we don't open unnecessary trust lines, such as trusting the Oracle just to deliver the data in a way that it can be tampered with.
Do you have a friend who's interested in getting into cryptocurrency, but they don't know where to start building their portfolio? Well, we have the answer. It's called CopyTrader by eToro. With CopyTrader, you can automatically copy every trade of eToro's top crypto traders, just like myself or Bryce or Kevin, at the exact price point and in real time. No need to study up on markets or develop your own strategies. Simply just sign up and copy our trades. Any profits that we make, you do too, proportional to your investment, of course. With eToro, you get access to the world's most popular cryptocurrencies with transparent trading fees all in one easy-to-use app. Copy the smart money with eToro. Join now at etoro.com/crypto101. Thank you.
So I know you guys just announced a very big announcement in Osaka at DevCon, which was, I think, last week or 2 weeks ago, and it is about the P token. And this has gotten a lot of discussion in the community, and people are kind of curious, so what's going on with the P token? What is it? How does it work in the system? And why is it so critical to the DeFi infrastructure?
So the P token is actually technology, so we typically refer to it as P tokens, as we could potentially have many P tokens. So the P stands for provable, pegged, and portable. So they are basically the three main keywords that we want to use to describe them. And what they are is basically a provable based technique that could enable crypto assets, let's say tokens in most cases, to basically move from one blockchain to another. So we could call this like a two-way peg if you want. So what it means that is, for instance, you could have an EOS as a token, like EOS, being used on Ethereum. So this would be called in that. This is actually the very first P token we are going to release in a few days. So it will be called PEOS, which means, you know, it's the P token representation of EOS on Ethereum. So this is basically a way to use EOS on the Ethereum platform. You can potentially also do the opposite, right? You can have like PETH on EOS. Or you could use think of any token on Ethereum. You could have the P token representation on another blockchain, or you could have any existing token from any blockchain living on Ethereum. So this is quite interesting because it solves an existing limitation of DeFi, which is the fact that DeFi, for its composability property, is mostly getting traction on Ethereum. Like, people keep building DeFi products on Ethereum because there are already, you know, the foundations of it on Ethereum. However, if we want to, if we look at like the first, 10 or 20 assets on CoinMarketCap that, you know, are making the majority of, you know, the market cap, but also of the liquidity in this space, you will see that they are not all Ethereum based. So what happens is that DeFi is somehow limited by the platform where it lives. So one of the first examples to solve that we have already seen with Bitcoin on Ethereum. There are a few projects that are trying to have Bitcoin living as an Ethereum token. So the most widely used at the moment is called Wrapped Bitcoin, which is WBTC. So this is something that is always referred to also as it's used by Compound, for instance. But many platforms are starting to use WBTC. So PBTC, for instance, is a P token representation of Bitcoin on Ethereum, and it would be possible to have it. We are not starting with that. We are starting with EOS instead, because there are already existing implementations of Bitcoin on Ethereum, so we are not in a rush, to solve a problem there that other people are already solving. Also, there is, TBTC, there is SBTC. There are already, few competing approaches that are trying to bring the liquidity of Bitcoin on the Ethereum platform. However, the pBitcoin approach is much wider in scope, as it could potentially go in support of some of those approaches to secure them, to provide additional transparency to the way they work, and it could be used with any token, so it's not limited to Bitcoin itself. So the way pTokens work is basically by using some trusted computing techniques. So trusted computing is like a set of technologies that basically provide guarantees for the execution of a given piece of code, of a given software. And these guarantees are provided by a process of hardware isolation. So you basically get a piece of code, execute it on a fully locked down chip, and the producer of the chip, which may be, Qualcomm, it may be Intel, it may be Apple, it may be, anyone building chips, basically they could give you a signature saying that according to them, your piece of code was executed correctly on their machine in a fully locked down environment. So this is not like a decentralized approach to transparent execution of code, which is what we have with smart contracts, right? But this doesn't have the limitations of blockchain either. So we can go beyond the limitations of blockchain and yet get some guarantees. And there are some ways, now I don't want to spend too much time going into the technical details, but there are some ways where basically this approach could be trust minimized, so that it becomes so unlikely that the someone could compromise or the correct execution that it's pretty much impossible. So this means we can lower the risk factor, the trust factor here, and we can come close to something a trustless execution. So this is just the beginning. We are releasing now the code base for the PEOS implementation, but this the reason why we're raising this now is to get some community feedback and see what the community thinks of this approach. But this same approach could be used for any token. So we think this could change a lot on the way DeFi evolves, as it will basically facilitate the increase in liquidity. And it will enable anyone with Bitcoin, for example, to issue, PBTC, or anyone with EOS to issue PEOS on Ethereum. So it's basically a system where people could freely move their existing liquidity from one blockchain to the other.
So is the way that this is kind of solved, like you set up an EOS contract that, or I guess I should say, how is it solved? Like if I send an EOS to this contract, then it mints a new PEOS on the Ethereum chain and it's locked. And then the only way that that could get unlocked is if it gets something deposited back to it from the Ethereum chain. Is that kind of how it works?
Yes, that's correct. That's a much simpler explanation. that's actually how it works from a high level. So the user perceives that logic flow, which is the important part, as everything is automated. So the user can freely, let's say you are a user with one PEOS token on Ethereum. What you could do after you have received it from someone else is potentially use a dApp that we are providing. And via this dApp, you can basically speak with both the Ethereum blockchain and the EOS blockchain. And basically, you can destroy, burn your PEOS token and get in exchange one EOS token on EOS. So you can send it straight to an exchange. And in this way, basically, your PEOS has been transferred to an exchange where you can potentially sell it for, USD or whatever you want. So basically, it's very easy for you to exchange one PEOS for any other token, regardless of where that other token lives. It may also not be on the same blockchain, or it may be, fiat currency itself. So it will be very easy for, market makers, or for anyone looking to do arbitrage with DeFi, or just people looking to move liquidity to do so via P tokens, because the peg process is automated and it takes basically a few seconds.
That sounds like a super amazing solution that you guys have come up with, basically unlocking cross-chain liquidity or, inter-blockchain communication. And it's something that, since I've been in this space, has been a problem that has always been talked about. And now finally here towards the end of 2019, the problem has been solved. So thank you for the P tokens. Let's talk about, I know you guys have a really cool app. I downloaded it and started playing around with it. It's called Eido. Eidoo. And it's a wallet. It's an exchange. It's got a lot of interesting stuff. Could you talk a little bit about that platform and some of the DeFi integrations and partnerships that are a part of that?
Yep. So Eido is an ecosystem. It has the form of a mobile application, but what it really does is simplifying access to a decentralized exchange on Ethereum, to some of DeFi tools that we like interacting with. I will mention some of this in a bit. And it gives access also to a crowdfunding platform. So if you need to do KYC, you can just do KYC once with a part of the service, which is called Eido ID. And this gives you access to pretty much any service where some kind of identification is needed because of regulation. So what that application does is basically lowering the entry barrier for those kind of tools. So you can potentially, in most cases, I would say avoid doing KYC and going straight to the smart contracts, right? But since the application is somehow intermediating between the user and the smart contract, in some cases, in order to comply with regulation, we had to ask for the documents before helping the user to interact with the smart contract. So the wallet, the application, is actually non-custodial. So the user is always in control of the private keys, and Eido cannot really, steal funds or do anything bad, but it helps to interact with smart contracts. So in some cases, the verifications are needed, other times they are not. So another service that is part of that is like a swap, where right now we have represented as our swap things that are typically also not seen as such. So for example, if you want to interact with Compound, just to give an example, let's say you have DAI and you want to get interest on DAI. So what you would like to get in exchange is something called CDAI, right? Which is the Compound token for DAI, which is interest bearing. So what you could do is going via the swap, which is basically just one swipe away from the application. So you just swipe on the DAI token and you click on swap and you exchange the DAI with CDAI. So it's like if conceptually you were exchanging one token with the other, what you're really doing is under the hood, you are sending a specific call to the smart contract of Compound. So there is an integration with Compound where basically it gives you back the CDAI token. And straight from the application, we are among the very few wallets where basically you see details for, once you have CDAI. So you can see the accrued interest or you can see the underlying asset balance or things like that. So it's very neat as straight from your wallet without going to the dApp, you can see all the details for, your integration with your interaction with Compound. So that's quite useful, as today we are seeing, tools such as InstaDApp or, the different dApps being built in a way where basically we need a dApp browser and then we go to the specific dApp to interact with this DeFi system or another DeFi system. While what Edu is doing some tight integrations with the most widely used services in DeFi space, so that basically using them gets easier and easier. And the average Joe doesn't even need to know, what a dApp is. They just, use the wallet and they see that they can get interest on a stablecoin. So if they have ETH, they can just, with like a couple of clicks, get some DAI. And then from DAI, in a couple of clicks, they can just, get interest and see how much interest they have got over time and things like that. So it's a very simple interface. Something else we are doing now, we have just released, is also an initial integration with Fulcrum, and we are going to release like more integrations over time. The idea is that all the different financial tools you may need in the ecosystem will be like at your fingertips without the need to go straight to the dApp. So you can potentially go to the dApp if you want, right? But I think this is still too much like complicated for the average Joe to use. It's like quite for techies, I would say. While if you have like a simple mobile application that gives you access to the power of those tools without you to, study hours and hours to understand how it works and how it's supposed to work and check if you're doing everything correctly, then I think we can lower the entry barrier more and more, and it will be like we will get traction faster.
I completely agree. It's a huge problem in the space. Just like a little personal anecdote, I opened up a Maker CDP, and like I just like, oh, I'm just gonna open it up, for like $50 or $100 or whatever, something small that if it completely goes to zero, then whatever. And like I still am confused on how to like close it, and so I might actually ask you to help me after that. But yeah, I mean, I love the idea of you download an app, you get all your DeFi apps there, and with a couple clicks or a swipe, then you now could utilize this dApp without having to understand all the technicalities behind it. So, our motto here at Crypto 101 is the average consumer's guide to cryptocurrency. So it sounds like that's pretty in line with what you guys are doing at Provable and at IDO. Awesome. So in closing, one of the things that we like to ask everybody is, who is one of the people that has made a big impression on you or somebody that you admire from afar, the work that they've done and the contributions that they've made to the space?
That's a good question. As like a few weeks ago, I was at DEF CON in Osaka, and I saw the presentation from one of the founders of archive.org. And I think that project is like very, I mean, it has been really critical in enabling the knowledge transfer of what has happened in the very first years of the internet till today. It's like general archive of human knowledge, so not just limited to digital informations, but also to books, movies, and all kind of stuff. So I think his presentation was really interesting, but this made me thinking basically what my conclusion was after his presentation is that really we are like building this whole ecosystem, on the shoulders of like the giants that in the late 80s, early 90s have driven the first cypherpunk movement, basically. So I'm still reading in the different crypto mailing lists like the messages that like Satoshi was writing back then, or also Peter Todd when he was 16 or also on Bitcoin Talk. Like I remember still diving into posts of written by Hal Finney in 2011 on the use of trusted computing and blockchain. So things that today are just being built now by innovative startups were already designed in principle and taught by those people that were very early. So they were completely wrong with their timing, but at the same time they were so right pushing for the right concepts and for what today is finally getting some traction with cryptography becoming more and more mainstream thanks to its use with blockchain. So I think all those people have really made it possible and enabled us to be here today. So I think they've been an example. And thanks to the internet, we know what they were saying back then, and we can still make good use of it. So I think there is still a lot to be read and a lot to be implemented based on their initial thoughts.
That sounds amazing. A lot of really, really influential people. Peter Todd is one of the main Bitcoin core devs. Hal Finney, who a lot of people suspect is in the group that is Satoshi Nakamoto. Archive.org, one of these websites where you could go to this website, archive.org, and then basically see what a web page looked like at any time in its history. It's kind of an amazing thing. And I wish I saw that presentation. I'll have to go check it out if it's online somewhere. So good call outs, good shout outs. The very last question I'll ask is, what is some other company in the space that is making leaps and bounds for us that really inspires you? That's a company that you look up to that impresses you?
I'm quite impressed by the developments of Set Protocol by Token Sets. So this project is really interesting to me. But in general, I think that many companies in DeFi have done an impressive work, given that this term didn't even exist until early this year. So I feel like we are moving faster and faster in this space, which is what we get from interoperability and composability. People say DeFi tools are like Lego blocks, and I think that that's right. That's exactly what all those companies are doing, and Token Set specifically, I think they are building something very powerful that will become the foundations many tools that will be critical for the success of the technology in the Ethereum space and maybe also on other platforms. So I think that many of those companies that we see in the DeFi space are trying to push the boundaries on the Ethereum platform. So the way I think it could contribute to it is by helping basically going beyond those boundaries by using via DP tokens, maybe all the liquidity that we have on the other chains, on the other tokens, so that they could use it within their own projects. So that once they are ready and they are finished with filling up all the Ethereum blockchain with as much as we could build there, they will still benefit from what people have built on other platforms. And at the end of the day, I think in a few years, what we'll see is that there will be no clear boundaries between those different blockchains. So what it will mean is that at the end, the the power of every single blockchain will be shared, the liquidity will be shared among blockchains, and everything will easily float from you know, one blockchain to the other with very small friction. So I think at the end of the day, this will be what DeFi will be about. It will not be about, you know, smart contracts on Ethereum. It will be in general about you know, unleashing the power of decentralized finance regardless of the underlying platform.
Amazing. Well, Thomas, thank you so much for your time today. And if the good people of Crypt Nation want to find out more about you, want to follow your Twitter, do you have those handles off the top of your head?
Yeah, my personal Twitter handle is like my first and last name, so Thomas Bertani, while the one of Eidu is like Eidu.io, and the one of Provable is Provable XYZ.
Perfect. I'll link to those in the show notes, as well as to all your guys' websites. Thank you so much for joining us, and we will catch you around.